Usually when we talk about daydreaming, it's a pretty fleeting thing.
Oh, definitely.
Like you're sitting at your desk, the glow of your monitor is giving you that slight, afternoon headache.
Right, the 3 p.m. slump.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And you catch yourself just staring out the window, imagining something entirely different.
A beach somewhere, usually.
Right. You picture this gentle ocean breeze, maybe a laptop resting on a bamboo table, and the sound of waves crashing just a few hundred meters away.
It's comforting. I mean, we all do it.
We really do.
Yeah.
But then, for some of you listening right now, that daydream starts to, I don't know, shift a little.
It gets real.
Yeah, it morphs from a fantasy into a genuine curiosity and then into an actual tangible goal.
Which is a huge leap.
It is. You start wondering, like, could I actually buy a piece of land in Indonesia? Could I build a villa there?
And the moment you transition from daydreaming to, actively Googling it,
Oh, man.
yeah, the fantasy collides pretty hard with reality.
That collision is just so jarring.
Yeah.
Because the reality of international real estate is, well, it's an absolute wall of incredibly confusing, often completely contradictory information.
It really is. I mean, the initial excitement gets buried so fast under legal jargon and, frankly, horror stories.
It is the absolute definition of a confusing landscape. Like you start reading expat forums and you see these incredible photos of pristine
And
beaches.
gorgeous beaches, yeah.
But then right below those photos, you read about someone losing their entire life savings on a bad land deal.
Just because they didn't understand the local laws.
Right. And suddenly that beautiful daydream is completely overshadowed by a very real, very rational fear.
And, we should validate that fear immediately.
Totally.
Because when you are operating outside your home country, outside the legal system and the property norms you instinctively understand, the risks are just magnified exponentially.
Yeah, the safety nets you rely on back home simply do not exist in the same way,
Exactly.
which is exactly why we are doing this deep dive today.
Yeah.
Today is for anyone who has ever seriously entertained the idea of buying property in South Lombok, Indonesia.
We are going to take that fear, basically drag it out into the light, and completely dismantle it.
Love that. And to do that, we have this incredible stack of sources to guide us today.
We really do.
We are looking at the South Lombok Property Investment Guide, and also the incredibly comprehensive 2026 South Lombok Master Plan.
Both of which were prepared by Lombok Compass.
Right. And they are fundamentally designed to be the ultimate guide to safely navigating this specific property market.
And what stands out about these documents, I mean, they don't just sell the dream of a tropical lifestyle.
No,
They
darn
painstakingly detail the actual mechanics of the reality. They treat the reader like a serious investor who needs to understand the plumbing of a real estate transaction, not just the glossy facade.
Absolutely. So our mission for this deep dive is to be your ultimate guide alongside these sources.
We're going to walk you through everything.
Literally everything. We will break down the exact per area pricing across the coast.
We'll walk step by step through a massive buyer's checklist.
And I think most importantly, we're going to show you exactly how to avoid the catastrophic legal mistakes that trip up so many foreign
It's
buyers.
so crucial.
So what does this all mean? It means we aren't just going to read you a list of real estate rules today.
No, definitely not.
We're going to give you a master class in how to think, act, and protect yourself like a seasoned international property investor.
Because it really is about building a mental framework.
Right.
Once you understand the underlying logic of how property rights and transactions actually function in Indonesia, the fear just dissipates.
It transforms from an overwhelming gamble into a highly methodical step-by-step process.
Exactly.
Okay, so let's start with the macro view.
Good place to start.
Because before we get into the heavy legal weeds of how to buy a property safely, we need to establish why you should even be deploying capital into South Lombok right now, specifically in 2026.
Right, the why before the how.
Yeah. And to understand the gravity of what is happening there, we have to talk about its very famous, very mature neighbor,
Bali.
Bali.
You really cannot understand the current momentum in South Lombok without understanding the trajectory of Bali over the last 2 decades.
True.
The sources repeatedly use a very specific phrase to describe South Lombok. They call it Bali, 15 years ago.
I love that phrase. It instantly sets a scene, doesn't it?
Oh, completely.
Like if you know Southeast Asia, you picture early Canggu or Seminyak.
Dirt roads, a few pioneer surfers.
Local warungs and land that was trading for literally pennies on the dollar compared to what it's worth today.
Exactly. But let's look at the actual momentum driving that comparison.
Because it's not just a clever marketing tagline to lure tourists.
No, there's real quantifiable data backing this up in the master plan. We aren't just talking about a sleepy, undiscovered island anymore.
Right. We're talking about major systemic government-backed growth.
For instance, the data shows the Mandalika area in South Lombok drew 1.2 million visitors in 2024.
Wow. 1.2 million.
Yeah. And to put that into perspective, the critical part of the statistic is the growth rate. That represents a 51% year-on-year increase.
Wait, 51%? In a single year?
In a single year.
That is an explosive trajectory for tourism arrivals.
It really is. It means the physical infrastructure, the roads, the restaurants, the beds available, it's all constantly playing catch-up to the sheer volume of human beings arriving on the island.
And it's being driven by massive, highly visible infrastructure upgrades too, right?
Oh, absolutely.
You have the MotoGP circuit, which literally puts the island on the global sporting map.
It draws hundreds of thousands of domestic and international fans.
Right. And you have the Mandalika Special Economic Zone,
which the Indonesian government specifically designed to streamline and accelerate foreign investment.
Exactly. And then you have the heavy-hitting hospitality brands moving in. Like, the sources highlight the opening of the first destination by Hyatt in all of Southeast Asia.
Right there on the South Lombok coast.
Yeah.
And, I mean, the arrival of a brand like Hyatt is a crucial indicator.
How so?
Well, when a multinational hospitality conglomerate commits hundreds of millions of dollars to a location, they aren't guessing.
Right. They aren't just crossing their fingers.
No, they have entire departments dedicated to geopolitical forecasting, economic modeling, demographic shifts.
They do their homework.
Exactly. Their arrival acts as a massive signal of confidence to the broader market. It tells smaller developers and individual investors that the institutional money has arrived.
And the master plan reports that this institutional catalyst has pushed land price increases to plus 50% in certain parts of the coast recently.
Plus 50%, yes.
That kind of return is just staggering. But I want to look at this analytically.
Sure.
Because the investment guide lays out the Bali versus Lombok trade-off with refreshing honesty. Mm. It's not a simple apples-to-apples comparison, is it?
Not at all. Bali and South Lombok offer two completely different value propositions.
Right.
And they require completely different investor mindsets. Let's take Bali first. Bali is a mature market. Prime hotspots like Canggu, Uluwatu, or Perenan, they have experienced decades of compounding price growth.
So the entry tickets there are now exceptionally high.
Very high. Buying a well-located plot in Canggu today requires serious established wealth.
It's expensive just to get your foot in the door.
It is. But in exchange for that high entry price, Bali gives you maturity and maximum liquidity.
Makes sense.
Because the market is so established, if you buy a well-built villa in a good area of Bali, it is relatively easy to resell it.
Right. The pool of potential buyers is massive and global.
Exactly. Furthermore, Bali has proven year-round rental demand.
It has that deep, established ecosystem.
Tourists, digital nomads, expats. If you want a turnkey asset, something you can buy on Monday and start generating reliable, predictable rental income from our Tuesday, Bali is still the undisputed leader.
It has the airport capacity, the international hospitals, the international schools.
All of it.
But the downside to all that maturity is the congestion.
Oh, the traffic.
The traffic in Bali is legendary at this point. It really is.
The sheer density of development has fundamentally altered the lifestyle that made it famous in the first place.
And that congestion is the push factor,
yeah,
driving people across the water to South Lombok.
Which brings us back to the Bali 15 years ago dynamic.
Right, right.
South Lombok is an early stage market.
Because it is earlier in its development cycle, it is a lower entry market.
So for the exact same budget that might buy you, like, a tiny walled-in plot sandwiched between two noisy cafes in a crowded Bali neighborhood,
you can acquire significantly larger plots in South Lombok.
Often with sweeping ocean views or direct beach access.
Exactly. But the trade-off, of course, is the risk profile and the timeline.
Right. It's not a magic bullet.
No. South Lombok offers faster percentage growth and much higher upside potential, but it comes with the friction of an emerging market.
What kind of friction?
Well, the rental market there is younger. It is more seasonal compared to Bali's year-round machine.
Yeah. Yes. Tourism is growing incredibly fast, and well-run villas in Lombok report strong gross yields. But those are emerging trends, not decades-old guarantees.
And the liquidity is vastly different. Let's expand on that liquidity aspect.
Sure.
The guide calls South Lombok A lumpy market.
Lumpy, yes.
If I'm a buyer, how should I visualize a lumpy market versus a liquid one?
Think of selling a property in Bali like selling a blue chip stock on the open market.
Okay.
There are thousands of buyers active every second. You can offload it quickly if you accept the market price.
Right.
Selling a property in South Lombok is more like selling a unique piece of fine art.
Oh, that's a great analogy.
The value might be incredibly high and it might be appreciating rapidly, but you can't just sell it overnight.
You have to wait for the specific buyer who recognizes the value of that specific piece of land.
Exactly. It fundamentally requires a holding period.
I'm glad you used the stock analogy because I want to push back on this momentum narrative just a little bit.
Okay, let's hear it.
When you hear phrases like Bali 15 years ago and plus 50% price increases, it's very easy for a listener to get swept up in the hype.
Very easy.
It sounds a lot like real estate FOMO, you know, fear of missing out. People panic, they think the window is closing, and they make rash decisions.
Oh, we see it all the time.
Right. So how do we separate legitimate early stage investing from just blind FOMO?
It's a crucial distinction. FOMO implies you are buying simply because prices are going up and you don't want to be left behind without understanding the underlying mechanics.
Yeah, just chasing the chart.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Calculated entry, on the other hand, means you understand why the prices are going up.
The 1.2 million visitors, the new infrastructure.
Right. And you have deliberately aligned your capital with the required timeline. If we connect this to the bigger picture, the psychological profile of the typical South Lombok buyer is someone who watched Bali's rise from the sidelines.
Oh, yeah.
They saw the early investors in Canggu make generational wealth. They are kicking themselves for not taking the leap back then.
And they absolutely refuse to miss that same window of opportunity twice.
Exactly.
So if buying in Bali right now is like buying Apple or Microsoft.
Safe, reliable dividend yield, but the days of the stock doing a 10x multiplier are long gone.
Right. Then South Lombok is like getting in on a Series A funding round for a highly promising tech startup.
That is a perfect way to look at it.
The entry price is much lower. The potential for the asset to double or triple in value is very real. But you're also taking on the inherent risks of a startup.
Exactly. The roads might still be under construction. The coffee shops haven't all opened yet.
The market is still proving its long-term viability.
And because you are investing in a startup environment, patience is the required currency.
The investment guide makes this uncompromisingly clear.
It does. If you want turnkey income today and you have the capital, go to Bali.
But if you want tomorrow's prices today and you have the patience to let the market mature around your asset,
you go to South Lombok.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because understanding that South Lombok requires a long-term mindset naturally brings up the absolute biggest source of anxiety for any foreign buyer.
The elephant in the room.
The elephant in the room. If I am deploying my hard-earned capital into this startup market and I am planning to hold it for 10, 20, or 30 years.
How do you legally own property in a country where you are not a citizen?
Exactly.
This is the critical threshold of the entire deep dive.
It really is.
If you get the legal structure wrong, everything else you discuss, the beautiful beaches, the rental yields, the area pricing, it's all completely irrelevant.
The investment guide and the master plan hit this point immediately, and they pull absolutely no punches.
None.
Foreigners absolutely cannot hold freehold title directly in Indonesia.
That title is called SHM. Which stands for Hak Milik.
Hak Milik, okay.
Hak Milik is the strongest, most absolute form of land ownership in Indonesia.
Like fee simple in the U.S.
Exactly. It is full, permanent, hereditary ownership. And under the Indonesian constitution, it is strictly reserved for Indonesian citizens. Period. A foreigner, under any circumstances, cannot hold an SHM title in their own name.
And the law is designed to protect the national land supply from being entirely bought out by foreign capital, right?
Exactly.
That single fact, the constitutional inability to hold freehold land, is what generates 90% of the fear and probably 99% of the terrible advice you find on the internet.
Oh, the forums are full of terrible advice. It creates a vacuum of understanding, and opportunists rush in to fill that vacuum with illegal shortcuts.
But the guide is very reassuring here. While you cannot hold SHM directly, you are not locked out of the market.
Not at all.
There are three highly secure, well-established, and legally enforceable alternative routes.
Routes that foreign buyers, multinational corporations, and major hotel chains use successfully every single day.
So let's walk through those three legal routes in detail. Because as the guide points out, The route you choose depends entirely on what your end goal is.
Exactly. Form must follow function.
Okay, route number one is leasehold. In Indonesian, this is called hak sewa. I'm assuming this is similar to leasing a house back home, but on a much longer timeline.
That's a good way to look at it. You are not buying the underlying land. You are leasing the land, or the completed villa, from the Indonesian freehold owner for a fixed long-term period.
Okay.
In South Lombok, this is commonly structured for 25 to 30 years up front.
But wait, what happens at year 25? Do you just hand the keys back and walk away with nothing?
Not if the contract is drafted correctly. A robust leasehold agreement will have pre-agreed extension rights built into the notarized contract.
Like an option to renew.
Exactly. You might see it written as 25 plus 25 years.
Okay.
This means you have the legally binding option to extend the lease for another 25 years at a price metric determined today.
Oh, that's smart. So it's tied to a specific inflation index or a predetermined market rate.
Right. Your protection in a leasehold lives entirely within the strength of that notarized contract.
Got it.
If you fail to lock in the extension terms up front, the landowner can demand an exorbitant price at year 25, effectively holding you hostage.
Yeah, that makes sense. And who does this leasehold route suit best?
It requires a significantly lower upfront cost compared to setting up corporate structures.
Okay.
Therefore, the guide identifies this as the ideal route for lifestyle buyers.
Right. People looking for a holiday home, digital nomads who want a base for a few months a year.
Or someone with a smaller budget who wants to secure a foothold and enjoy the asset without the burden of corporate compliance.
Okay, so that's leasehold. The second route is hak pakai, which translates to right to use.
Yes.
How does this differ from a lease?
Hak pakai is an actual state registered title, not just a private contract between you and a landowner.
Oh, okay. That sounds stronger.
It is, but it has very strict limitations. It is specifically designed for foreign individuals who hold akitas.
Akitas is like an Indonesian residency or work permit, right?
Exactly. And it's only for those who are buying a property to use strictly as their primary residence.
So if I'm an investor sitting in London and I want to buy a plot in Lombok, build a villa, and rent it out on Airbnb while I stay in the UK, hak pakai is useless to me.
Worse than useless, it would be a direct violation of the title conditions.
Wow, okay.
Hak pakai is strictly for a primary home that you intend to live in yourself. It is not for commercial rental operations.
Good to know.
If you attempt to run a rental business on a hak pakai title, the government can revoke it.
Just take it back.
Yes. It is granted for an initial term of 30 years, extendable for 20, and renewable for another 30.
So 80 years total.
Right. It's a very clean route, but only if you are actually relocating your life to Indonesia.
Which brings us to the third route.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the absolute heavy hitter for investors, the PTPMA.
Yes.
Let's really break this down because the acronym gets thrown around a lot.
It does. PTPMA stands for Perseroan Turbatas Penanaman Modal Asing.
Which is quite a mouthful.
In English, it simply means a foreign-owned limited liability company.
Okay. So the mechanism here is that I am not buying the land as an individual foreigner.
Right.
I am legally establishing an Indonesian corporation, which I own 100% of, and that corporate entity is the legal entity buying the property.
Exactly. And when an Indonesian corporate entity, even one owned by foreigners, buys property, it is allowed to hold a very powerful title called HGB.
HGB?
Or hak guna bangunan. This translates to the right to build.
Right. And why is the PTPMA holding an HGB title the gold standard for investors?
Because it is the only structure that legally allows for commercial profit-generating use.
Ah.
If you want to generate rental income, if you want to hold multiple assets in a portfolio, or if your strategy is to buy raw land, develop a villa, and flip it for a profit,
yeah,
you must use a PTPMA.
It gives you the legal right to run a property business and repatriate those profits back to your home country.
Exactly.
The HGB title under PTPMA also works on a term basis.
It does.
The guide says it starts with 30 years plus a 20-year extension plus a 30-year renewal. So again, you are looking at an 80-year horizon.
Yes. And the mechanical reality here is that the underlying land technically remains freehold owned by someone else or sometimes relinquished to the state.
Okay.
But your PTPMA holds the absolute right to use, build on, and profit from that land for that 80-year span.
Now, setting up a foreign company sounds incredibly daunting.
It sounds scary, yeah.
The sources point out that setting up a PTPMA is a known, standardized process managed by local agencies. But it does come with real costs.
No, definitely.
They note that the initial setup often starts around $20 million Indonesian rupiah.
Which converts to roughly 1,200 to 1,300 US dollars.
Okay, that's not terrible.
That is the administrative cost to incorporate. But the guide wisely warns buyers the PTPMA is not just a piece of paper you buy once and put in a drawer.
Right.
It is a living corporate entity. You are essentially becoming an Indonesian corporate director.
Which means compliance.
Exactly. You have annual tax reporting obligations, you need to maintain proper bookkeeping, and you have to show legitimate business activity.
So you have to pay local accountants to keep the company compliant.
Yes. If you fail to maintain compliance, the state can freeze your company, which instantly jeopardizes the assets it holds.
Okay, and beyond the corporate setup, the guide lists the other financial realities of these structures.
The soft costs.
Right. You have notary fees, you have transfer taxes, and if your plan is to buy land and build, they note that construction costs in South Lombok currently average between 10 to 22 million rupiah per square meter.
That's roughly 600 to 1,400 US dollars per square meter, depending on the level of luxury.
That is a crucial detail for anyone building a budget.
It is a very common mistake for foreign buyers. They look at a beautiful piece of land for $50,000, look at their bank account, which has $55,000, and think they can afford it.
Yeah, they forget that the legal setup, the notary, the acquisition taxes,
they
all add up quickly and need to be factored into the initial capital deployment.
Precisely.
All right, we have established the three legal safe routes, but I need to bring up something that we see everywhere.
I know what you're going to say.
If you spend 10 minutes on any social media group discussing Indonesian real estate, you will inevitably see someone suggest a shortcut.
The infamous shortcut.
They will say, look, setting up a PTPMA sounds like a headache. Don't bother with all that corporate compliance.
Right.
Just find a local Indonesian citizen, maybe someone you trust, like a driver or a friend of a friend, pay them a fee, and put the free old SHM deed in their name.
Yeah.
They hold it for you, and you sign a separate paper saying it's really yours.
Mm-hmm.
This is known as a nominee arrangement.
I'm so glad we reached this point.
Yeah.
Because this is the single most important part of this entire deep dive. We need to be absolutely unequivocal here.
The investment guide calls this out aggressively, and I want to understand exactly why.
They call it out because nominee arrangements are explicitly illegal.
Illegal.
Yes. They are fundamentally designed to circumvent the Indonesian constitution, which, as we establish, strictly prohibits foreigners from holding freehold land.
But people still do it.
All the time.
They argue that they have ironclad side agreements drafted by lawyers stating, yes, the land is in the local's name, but I provided the funds, and they cannot sell it without my permission.
And this is where the mechanism of the law crushes that logic.
How so?
Under Indonesian law, those side agreements are legally void the exact moment they are signed.
Wait, really?
You cannot create a legally binding contract to break the law.
Oh, that makes total sense.
The courts view it as an attempt to smuggle foreign ownership into the country. Therefore, if you use a nominee, you have absolutely zero legal standing.
Wow.
You do not own the land. The Indonesian citizen whose name is on that SHM certificate owns the land 100%.
So let's play out a scenario here.
Okay.
Imagine a buyer spends $200,000 to buy land and build a beautiful villa using a nominee structure. Everything is fine for 5 years. Then, tragically, the Indonesian nominee passes away. What happens?
It is a total disaster for the foreign buyer. Because the land legally belongs to the nominee, upon their death, it immediately transfers to their legal heirs, their children, or extended family.
Oh, no.
And those heirs are under no legal obligation to honor a voided side agreement made by their deceased baron.
They could just take it.
They can simply walk into the villa, change the locks, and take possession.
And what if the foreign buyer tries to take it to court?
The judge will look at the BPN registry, see the deceased citizen's name, recognize that the foreigner was attempting to bypass constitutional law, and rule in favor of the heir.
The foreigner loses everything.
Everything. They are effectively evicted from the home they paid for.
Or even without a tragedy, the nominee could just wake up one day, realize they legally own a $200,000 asset, and sell it to someone else without telling the foreigner.
Exactly. The guide says nominee structures are the most common way foreigners lose all their money and describes them as legally fragile.
Illegally fragile.
I would argue that legally fragile is too polite.
Yeah, sounds like it.
They are a ticking time bomb. The golden rule, the absolute non-negotiable law of investing in South Lombok or anywhere in Indonesia is this. You must never, ever use a nominee structure.
Never.
Never. There are three perfectly legal, highly secure routes. Leasehold, Hak Pakai, and PTPMA. There is zero logical or financial justification for taking on the catastrophic risks of a nominee.
That is crystal clear. The shortcut is a cliff. No nominees.
Ever.
Ever. Okay, so assuming we were taking the high road, say setting up a PTPMA, we know the legal structure, but knowing how to own it legally is only half the battle.
That's right.
Because as we established earlier, South Lombok is a rapidly growing early stage market.
And rapid unregulated growth always acts as a magnet for bad actors.
Exactly. Opportunists, scammers, people looking to make a quick buck off confused foreigners arriving with deep pockets and little local knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you actually bulletproof your investment? How do you protect your capital before a single rupee leaves your bank account?
Well, this is where the master plan transitions from legal theory into active defense.
Good.
They dedicate an entire section to title safety and red flags. And they point out that the mistake that costs buyers their capital is almost universally the same, skipping independent verification.
Oh, yeah. You can picture it. A buyer finds a stunning plot of land overlooking the ocean. The seller is friendly. The price feels like a steal, and the buyer gets so caught up in the excitement that they just trust the paperwork handed to them.
Exactly. And to prevent that exact scenario, the guide provides three essential checks that catch the vast majority of problems.
Let's go through them. Check number one.
Verify the BPN certificate.
I know BPN stands for Badan Pertanahan National. How does this registry actually work?
The BPN is Indonesia's national land agency. It is the official government-maintained ledger of who owns what piece of land in the country.
Okay.
When a property is sold, the transaction isn't truly finalized until the BPN updates their ledger.
The guide is incredibly specific here. It says you must verify the original certificate against the national registry, not just look at a photocopy provided by the seller. Why is a photocopy useless?
Because a photocopy can be manipulated with basic editing software in 10 minutes.
Right, cool.
A seller could show you a photocopy of a clean title, hiding the fact that the original has a massive bank lien against it, or is currently frozen due to an active court dispute.
That's terrifying.
You, or more accurately, your appointed legal representative, must take the unique details of the original physical certificate and cross-reference them directly with the BPN's digital and physical records.
Okay, and what exactly are you confirming?
You have to confirm three things. That the certificate is genuine, that there are no encumbrances or blocks on the title, and that the person standing in front of you claiming to be the seller is actually the legal owner registered with the state.
It sounds so basic. But when the pressure's on and people are rushing to close a deal, they skip it.
They do.
Okay, check number two is confirming the zoning.
This is a massive trap in South Lombok specifically because so much of the area is still raw agricultural land.
Right.
The guide explicitly warns against buying green zone land.
What makes green zone land so dangerous?
Green zone means the local spatial plan has designated that specific coordinate strictly for agriculture or forestry.
Okay, so you can't build.
Right. You might find a stunning piece of land rolling down a hill toward the beach, and it's suspiciously cheap.
And the reason it is cheap is that it's green zoned.
Exactly. If you buy it with your PTPMA intending to build a luxury rental villa, when you apply for your PBG, which is the building permit, the government will deny it.
You cannot legally pour concrete on green zone land.
You cannot. So now you own a very expensive patch of grass that generates no income.
A plot you cannot legally build on is not the plot you thought you bought. Your entire investment thesis is destroyed on day one.
You must have your notary check the official spatial plan maps before you commit.
Which leads perfectly into check number three.
Mm-hmm.
Independent due diligence. The guide has a strict rule. Always use your own notary. Never the sellers.
Yes.
And the notary in Indonesia is called a PP.
Correct. This is fundamentally about avoiding a conflict of interest. A notary who works for the seller or who is constantly fed deals by a specific agent has a primary loyalty to them. Their goal is to push the transaction through quickly to get everyone paid.
It's exactly like buying a used car.
How so?
You wouldn't let the guy selling you the car be the only mechanic who inspects the engine.
Oh, absolutely not.
You would take it to your own trusted mechanic to look under the hood and tell you what's really going on.
That is the perfect analogy. Your independent PPT is your trusted mechanic. They are the ones who dig into the ownership history.
Okay.
And one of the most critical things they look for, which the guide notes is very common in South Lombok, is hidden heirs.
Hidden heirs. How do hidden heirs happen? Is it just people hiding family members?
Not always maliciously. It's usually a byproduct of how land has traditionally been handled in rural Indonesia. Land is often communal family wealth.
Oh, I see.
A grandfather might have verbally divided a large plot of land among his three sons decades ago without ever formally updating the BPN registry. Those three sons have seven children each. Now, you are trying to buy that plot, and there are technically 21 fractional owners under the law.
21 owners?
Yes. If you only get signatures from the two uncles who currently farm it, and you miss the cousin living in Jakarta, that cousin can return 5 years later and legally contest the sale. Wow. Your independent notary traces the lineage to ensure every single legal heir signs the release.
So those are the three mandatory checks. Verify the BPN registry, confirm you aren't in a green zone, and use your own independent notary.
Yes.
But the guide also provides a fascinating list of red flags.
These are great.
These are the behavioral signs that a deal is toxic.
And this gets into the psychology of a scam. Scammers don't usually win on the legal merits. They win by manipulating human emotion.
Right. They prey on excitement and they manufacture artificial urgency.
Exactly.
The first red flag is exactly that. Pressure to pay deposit today to hold the land.
If a seller or an agent tells you that another buyer is looking at it right now and you need to wire a $5,000 deposit immediately to secure it before doing any due diligence, you walk away.
Just walk away.
Real, legitimate property transactions are built to survive a due diligence period.
Right.
A genuine seller understands that BPN verification takes time. Artificial urgency is the oldest trick in the book to separate you from your money before you find the hidden flaw.
Another red flag is any reluctance to show the original certificate.
Oh, yeah. If they say, don't worry about the certificate, my lawyer has it, or it's locked in a bank vault, just trust me for now.
The conversation is over.
Over. Without the original certificate, there is no transaction. Period.
We already covered the nominee red flag.
Yeah.
If they pitch a nominee structure as the normal, easy way foreigners do things around here, you run the other way.
Run fast.
Another flag the guide mentions is unexplainably cheap prices.
Again, you have to apply logic. If a plot is priced at 50% below the area average, and the seller can't clearly explain why maybe they claim they just need quick cash for a business venture, it is almost certainly a trap.
Right.
It is likely disputed family land, unbuildable green zone land, or a landlocked plot with no legal road access.
And the final red flag.
Yeah.
Cash only requests.
Everything legitimate in a property transaction is documented, routed through proper bank channels, and taxed appropriately by the government.
So if a seller wants off the record cash payments,
they're either trying to evade taxes, which instantly implicates you in tax fraud, or they're trying to steal the money without leaving a paper trail.
The guide sums this up brilliantly. They say, trust words, distrust words.
I love that section.
Phrases like guaranteed returns, act now, or nominee arrangement should immediately trigger your internal alarm system. Those are dangerous words.
Very dangerous.
But phrases like BPN certificate check, notarized contract, and zoning confirmed are the sound of safety.
And here is a crucial takeaway for the listener to internalize. If a seller or an agent resists your attempts to bring in an independent notary or acts offended when you insist on taking the time to verify the BPN certificate,
yeah,
that resistance is incredibly valuable information.
It's a massive tell.
It is not an inconvenience. It is a massive flashing warning sign that you just dodged a bullet.
Okay, so we know the legal armor. We need the PTPMA or the leasehold. We know the three critical safety checks to run and the behavioral red flags to watch out for.
We do.
But how do you actually apply that armor when you're standing in a muddy field in Lombok looking at a plot of land? What's the very first physical step?
This brings us to the operational core of the master plan. They break the entire journey down into a six-stage process covering 38 specific checks.
38 checks, wow.
It is designed to take you from the very first thought all the way to holding the clean title in your hands.
Let's walk through these stages. Stage A is before looking. And the very first thing they mandate is setting an all-in budget.
Right.
But they specifically note, you must add 10 to 15% on top of the headline price of the land.
That is so important.
Why is that buffer so critical?
Because, as we touched on earlier, the list price of the land is not the final amount of capital you will need to close the deal.
Right.
You have to account for the notary fees, the due diligence costs, and the government transfer taxes. Specifically, as a buyer, you are responsible for an acquisition tax called BPHTB, which is generally 5% of the transaction value.
Oh, okay.
If your absolute maximum budget is $100,000, you cannot look at $100,000 land.
Because by the time the taxes and notary fees hit, you will be short.
Exactly. You need to be looking at $85,000 land to leave room for the transactional friction.
The other part of Stage A that stands out is setting your timeline. The guide states that most successful buyers research for 6 to 18 months before pulling the trigger.
6 to 18 months. This is a profound point about buyer psychology.
I was so.
By explicitly normalizing a 6 to 18 month research phase, the guide is giving the buyer permission to be patient.
They're deliberately creating a calm, extended process.
Exactly, to counteract the desperation and FOMO that leads to catastrophic mistakes. You don't have to fly in and buy something on a 1 week holiday.
Stage B is vetting the location. And there is a piece of advice here that I find fascinating because it highlights the physical reality of the tropics.
Oh, the weather aspect.
Yeah, the checklist says visit at different times, morning, evening, and especially after rain. Check access roads in the wet season.
It is brilliant advice because the environment changes drastically.
Right.
A dirt access road in the dry season of August looks like a perfectly fine, functional road. You can drive a scooter down it. You can imagine driving an SUV to your future luxury villa.
But add 3 days of torrential tropical rain in January.
And that road might become an impassable river of mud, or worse, topographical runoff could wash out the retaining wall entirely. If you only visit during the dry season, you are missing half the reality of living in Lombok.
They also emphasize checking the utilities. Verify a real water source, well depth, PDAM, and proximity to power. These costs surprise buyers.
People from developed countries assume utilities are just there, waiting to be connected at the edge of the street.
Like it's a given.
Right. In an early stage market like South Lombok, they are not. If you buy a remote hilltop plot, because the view is incredible, you might discover that pulling an electrical line up that hill from the nearest village, or drilling a well deep enough through rock to hit reliable water during the dry season.
That sounds expensive.
It can add $30,000 or $40,000 to your build cost.
They also mentioned checking setbacks and coastline rules. You can't just build your living room right on the sand.
Correct. There are strict environmental and zoning regulations regarding how close to the high tide line you can build. You might buy a plot right on the beach, imagining stepping off your deck onto the sand, only to discover that the legal buildable area is pushed so far back that you can barely see the water through the trees.
That would be devastating.
Yeah.
Moving to stages C and D, verifying and pricing. The checklist insists on surveying the actual boundaries. Have the plot physically measured. Stated area and real area often differ.
This happens all the time.
Really?
Oh, yeah. The old BPN certificate from the 1990s might say the plot is exactly 1,000 square meters. But when your notary sends out a professional surveyor with modern GPS equipment,
They might find out it's not.
they might find the neighbor's wall actually encroaches by 2 meters and the usable land is only 900 square meters. You do not pay for land that isn't legally yours or physically available.
Which leads perfectly into the pricing negotiation. The guide says you must negotiate strictly on per R comparables. We are going to dig deep into what an R is in a moment, but essentially it's the unit of measurement. You don't just ask how much for the whole plot, you break it down to the unit price and compare it to what recently sold next door.
And the key word there is sold. You must base your negotiations on actual transaction data, not just what other sellers are listing their land for on Instagram or property portals.
Because asking prices can be crazy.
Asking prices in emerging markets are often entirely disconnected from reality, driven by wishful thinking rather than market fundamentals.
Makes sense. Stages E and F are legal, closing and after. This is where the paperwork happens. The guide stresses never paying in full before the transfer is complete.
Sure.
Use stage payments tied to verified milestones.
This is how you maintain leverage.
Okay.
You might pay a small deposit when the initial agreement is signed, a larger portion when your independent notary confirms the BPN title is clean and the heirs have signed, and the final portion only when the BPN registry is officially updated into your PTPMA's name.
Right, because if you hand over all the cash on day one, you lose the ability to force the seller to resolve any last-minute legal hiccups. They also mention ensuring the seller's taxes are settled. The seller owes an income tax on the sale, just as you owe the BPHTB acquisition tax.
If the seller takes your money and refuses to pay their required income tax to the state, the BPN will not process the final transfer of the title.
Wow, so you're stuck.
Your notary coordinates all of this, holding the funds in escrow if necessary, to ensure the government is satisfied before the deal truly closes.
And finally, After you own it, the work doesn't stop when you get the keys.
It really doesn't.
You have to store documents safely. You need a system to set reminders for lease renewals, which might be 25 years away, but you still need to track it, and you have to keep your PTPMA compliant with the annual government reporting.
It is a comprehensive, rigorous system.
But I have to ask, reading through this 38-point checklist across 6 stages, this sounds like a full-time job.
It can be.
How does someone sitting in a high-rise in New York or an office in Sydney actually execute this remotely? It feels overwhelming to manage GPS surveyors and check wet-season roads from thousands of miles away.
And that is exactly where a trusted local guide comes in. The master plan isn't suggesting you fly to Lombok for 6 months and start measuring land with a tape measure yourself.
Okay, good.
The guide outlines an orientation phase specifically designed for remote buyers.
Right. They mentioned starting with free orientation calls to understand your goals and budgets. They verify options and share documents, drone videos, and topographical reports long before you ever book a flight.
They act as your operational boots on the ground.
Okay.
They are running the preliminary checks on the 38-point list on their end, filtering out the green zone land and the uncooperative sellers.
Doing the heavy lifting.
The goal is that by the time you do plan a no-pressure viewing trip, you are only spending your limited time looking at fully vetted, legally sound properties that match your specific investment thesis.
Okay, so armed with this ultimate checklist and deeply understanding the legal routes, you are finally ready to look at a map. Where exactly should you deploy your capital based on what you want to achieve? Let's map out the coast and look at the real pricing.
Before we look at the specific bays and beaches, we must define the metric used for pricing in Lombok.
Good idea.
The master plan uses a unit called the R.
Spelled A-R-E. Let's pause on the math for a second, because when you look at these listings, you're not seeing square feet or square meters as the primary price driver like you would in the U.S. or Europe.
Right. One R is exactly 100 square meters.
Okay.
To visualize it easily, think of a 10 meter by 10 meter square. It's roughly the size of a very generous two-car garage or a small parking lot.
Got it.
In Lombok, all land is priced, negotiated, and discussed per R.
The guide provides an incredibly valuable snapshot of indicative per R pricing for 2026 across the South Coast. Let's walk through these areas geographically, starting with the established hub, Kuta Lombok.
Kuta Lombok is the center of gravity for the entire South Coast. It is where the infrastructure is most developed.
The pricing here reflects that maturity. It's listed at $25,000 to $45,000 U.S. dollars per R.
This is the premium pricing tier for the region. And what are you buying for that premium?
The amenities.
You are buying immediate access to amenities. Kuta has the paved roads, the high-speed fiber internet, the established cafes, the surf shops, the international schools, and the restaurants.
So it's basically a plug and play.
Because of that dense infrastructure, it offers the highest liquidity and the highest proven immediate rental demand on the coast.
So if your goal is immediate rental yield, you want to build a villa and have it booked out on Airbnb next year, and you want a relatively safer, more liquid asset that you could sell somewhat quickly, Kuta is the play.
Exactly. It's the closest thing South Lombok has to a mature, predictable market.
Next on the map, moving slightly west, is Silong Belanak. The guide calls it the postcard beach. Pricing here is $22,000 to $40,000 per R. What does a plot look like here?
Silong Belanak is famous for its gentle, sweeping white sand bay. It is visually stunning, the kind of place you see in luxury travel magazines.
Sounds beautiful.
The market dynamic here is characterized by very tight supply and fast rising land values.
The guide specifically says this area is best for lifestyle.
Because it is significantly quieter than Kuta. It appeals to a different kind of buyer, someone who wants that pristine, postcard-perfect, tropical living experience rather than the bustling, energetic cafe culture of Kuta.
Right.
It's a premium lifestyle choice, often attracting high-end luxury villa developments.
Then we move to what the guide labels the smart money or emerging plays. These are areas like Arguling and Gyurupuk.
What's fascinating here is how the physical geography dictates the investment strategy. Look at the pricing.
Arguling is priced at $9,000 to $16,000 per R. Gyurupuk is $10,000 to $18,000 per R. Notice the massive drop in the entry price compared to Kuta.
It's less than half the price.
Exactly. Why? Because these are early stage areas. Gyurupuk, for instance, is described as a working fishing bay that is slowly transitioning into a quiet investor favorite.
Okay.
It has incredible elevated ocean views and world-class surf access right in the bay, but it doesn't have the paved roads lined with avocado toast cafes and boutique shops yet.
So you don't buy in Gurupuk if you want turnkey, walk to the cafe convenience. You buy there for the massive percentage upside.
Precisely. You are intentionally buying the infrastructure lag. You are placing a calculated bet that the development spreading out from Kuta and the Mandalika zone will inevitably reach these bays in the next 3 to 5 years.
And when those roads get paved and the first few high-end cafes open, that $10,000 per our land will revalue significantly higher to match the new amenities.
It requires patience, and you might have to deal with dirt roads for a few years, but it offers the highest growth potential for your capital.
Finally, the guide highlights a very specific area on the coast, Tampa Beach. The pricing here is listed as from roughly $6,300 per hour. And they specifically note this is for direct access eco-luxury lots.
Tampa is presented as a unique opportunity within the guide. And this is where the specific role of the source materials creator, Lombok Compass, becomes very explicit in the transaction ecosystem.
Right. The investment guide is completely transparent about their position in the market. They act as an honest guide, and they mention that their shortlisting and guidance services, all the orientation calls and due diligence checks are entirely free to the buyers.
Okay, so how do they get paid?
They are paid through the transaction itself by the seller or the developer, and they are upfront about those referral arrangements.
But specifically regarding Tampa Beach, they note that they have deep, direct relationships with the owners of two major developments there, Tampa Reserve and Tampa Hills.
Tampa Hills is described as a massive 120-hectare seaside community with architect-designed luxury villas.
And because of those direct relationships, Lombok Compass states that buyers who come through them get first pick of the newly released plots, hands-on selection advice, and pricing that can actually come in below the public list price.
They explicitly say in the guide, ask us about Tampa before going direct.
It's a very compelling value proposition. They are leveraging their established local network and their volume of buyers to offer a tangible, immediate financial advantage to the individual investor.
Here's where it gets really interesting for me, though. It's not just the pricing advantage. It's the overall tone of how Lombok Compass operates. At the end of the master plan, there is a quote that perfectly summarizes their entire philosophy.
Well, let's hear it.
It says, "We will never make you feel naive for asking a question, and we will never let you buy something we would not buy ourselves."
That is a remarkable and, frankly, rare statement in the world of international real estate.
It's a completely different vibe from the high-pressure buy-it-now-or-lose-it sales tactics you see everywhere else. It reinforces the calm, methodical, 6 to 18 month research timeline they advocate for.
They're positioning themselves not as salespeople pushing a product, but as risk managers guiding a client through a complex environment.
Which is exactly what a foreign buyer in an early-stage market actually needs. They don't need someone to sell them the dream of a beach. The beach sells itself.
Yeah.
They need someone to navigate the harsh reality of the BPN registry, the spatial zoning laws, and the complex PMA compliance.
Let's synthesize the massive journey we have just taken today.
Good idea.
We started by looking at the macro potential of South Lombok. We saw the staggering 1.2 million visitors, the new Hyatt, the MotoGP circuit, and we finally understood the true weight of the Bali 15 years ago momentum.
We weighed the blue chip versus startup trade-offs, recognizing that while Lombok requires patience and tolerance for a lumpy market, it offers significant outsized upside for those who position themselves early.
We then tackled the scariest part, the legal reality.
Yeah.
We learned that while freehold SHM is constitutionally impossible for foreigners, you can secure your investment cleanly and permanently through a PTPMA holding an HGB title, a Hak Pakai for a primary residence, or a well-drafted leasehold agreement.
And we established the absolute non-negotiable golden rule. Never, ever use a nominee. We saw how that path leads directly to losing your entire investment.
We mapped out the strict three-check due diligence process, verifying the original certificate directly with the BPN, confirming you weren't stuck in a green zone, and using your own independent notary to ensure a clean title transfer free of hidden errors. And we learned how to spot the behavioral red flags of artificial pressure and cash-only requests.
Finally, we walk through the actual pricing across the coast, from the premium liquid market of Kuta to the high upside emerging bays of Gurupuk and the exclusive access at Pampa Beach.
If you are listening to this and you have absorbed this information, you now possess a mental framework that is far more robust than what most tourists have when they land on the island with a pocket full of cash and a dream.
Oh, absolutely.
In fact, Armed with this knowledge, you likely know more about the actual mechanics of safe property acquisition than many expats who have lived in Indonesia for years but never bothered to look past the surface. You don't have to guess anymore.
You have the checklist.
The fear of the unknown can now be entirely replaced with actionable, methodical, and legally safe steps. But before we wrap up this deep dive, there is one final layer to this whole conversation that isn't explicitly detailed in the legal checklists, but it hovers over everything we've discussed today.
Yes, it's a philosophical point about market entry, and it's something every potential buyer needs to consider.
Okay.
If South Lombok truly is Bali 15 years ago, that means the market is still highly malleable. It means the people who are entering the market today, the buyers purchasing the land, designing the villas, and setting up the businesses right now are the ones who are going to actively shape its future.
Wow, that's a big thought.
You are not just buying a passive asset on a spreadsheet. You are participating in the creation of a destination's culture. Buying land in an emerging market isn't just a financial transaction, it's a profound responsibility. Right. The choices made by early investors dictate whether an area becomes a sustainable, integrated community that respects the local environment, or just another congested, unsustainable strip of concrete.
So as you look at those maps and run those rigorous due diligence checks, the ultimate question isn't just, what can this land do for me financially?
Exactly. The real question to mull over is, what kind of destination do you want to build?